In the summer of 1972, Richard Nixon was president. A second-rate burglary at the Watergate office complex was just beginning to have wider implications. There was political upheaval in Chile. In Vietnam, the conflict had heated up with the bombing of Cambodia. And the Cold War between the Soviet Union and the United States showed few signs of thaw. In July and August, two men met across a chessboard in Reykjavik, Iceland. Boris Spassky and Bobby Fischer's competition for the title of world chess champion wiped all other news off the front page. David Edmonds and John Idenow tell the story in a new book, Bobby Fischer Goes to War, How the Soviets Lost the Most Extraordinary Chess Match of All Time, and they join us from London. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Why was the chess match captivating enough for TVs and bars in New York to be tuned to PBS to watch?
Well, it was portrayed at the time as a Cold War match, and that was part of what appealed to the newspapers. There was also, of course, Bobby Fischer's extraordinary personality. For Bobby Fischer, chess was life. He'd been obsessed with the game from the age of six, and he'd claimed he'd been the best player in the world for the last decade. And he was challenging the Soviet Union, who'd had a grip on the title ever since World War II. And the Soviet Union used chess as an example of how their system, in their eyes, was superior to capitalism. Chess was a way of proving that communism worked.
John, let's get a little more deeply into the personalities of the two combatants. In the book, you both write, the chess mentality offers rich pastures in which psychoanalysts can safely graze. With Bobby Fischer, for example, the demands that he would make. There was a joke going around Iceland that he demanded the setting of the sun 3 hours earlier.
Certainly, he had characteristics that you could only describe as dysfunctional, as almost, I suppose, extravagant. And they were characteristics that became more pronounced as he went on, as he got closer and closer to his challenge for the world title. What I think is of direct relevance for the game and how it came out was his demand for ever-increasing measures of control over the circumstances of the match. Control over money, control over the physical circumstances. And one of the intriguing features of this match in Iceland was the way in which he succeeded in imposing his control. We think really because the Icelanders had invested so much in it that they were not in a position to turn him down and have him walk away. So that was on the Bobby Fischer side. One of the interesting things about the match is, of course, that his personality then was perfectly well known. It was Spassky whose personality was not at all well known, shielded behind the Soviet monolith.
Yes, I mean, he was presented at the time as a product of the Soviet chess machine. Now, in part, that's true, but Spassky was a very complex personality. Spassky was by no means a good representative, as far as the authorities were concerned, of the Soviet system. Far from being a good communist, he was a good Russian. He wasn't a good Soviet. He was a Russian nationalist. And in his mind, in some ways, he was playing for Russia, not for the Soviet Union.
How much really was at stake politically? There's a story that is well known in chess lore that you tell, and you did an interview with Henry Kissinger, who was then the National Security Advisor. He made a phone call, but he told you it wasn't in an official capacity. And the line was, he was calling Bobby Fischer. Bobby Fischer was still in New York, and he was refusing to go to Reykjavik. And Kissinger says, this is the worst player in the world calling the best player in the world, and then proceeds to try to convince Bobby Fischer to really go and play the match. Was there enough at stake politically to involve the diplomatic corps?
Probably not. It's very plain, if you look at the Soviet side of it, that they did not see it as an ideological match, part of the Cold War. And certainly from the American administration point of view, Fischer, if anything, was an embarrassment He was not seen as the all-American that they should support. So from the American administration's point of view, it wasn't a Cold War match. And from the Soviet point of view, it was a very important world chess championship and they were facing an American for the first time. But it was not a Cold War match as such. The press, however, certainly saw it as a Cold War match, as did Fisher.
But nonetheless, I mean, Kissinger not only made one call to Bobby Fischer, it's thought he made two calls to Bobby Fischer. But he makes the first call when Bobby Fischer is refusing to go to Iceland because he's demanding more prize money. And it takes the intervention of a multimillionaire British businessman to double the prize money and to say, in effect, come out, Fischer, you chicken, come out and play. Fischer does turn up in Iceland, and then he forfeits game two because he complains that the cameras are being intrusive, and it looks like he's going to return to the United States. And then, for a second time, Kissinger calls him, and whether there was a cause-effect relationship, we just don't know, but Fischer stays in the match.
David, was it good chess?
Yes, I mean, the chess match takes place in various phases. Under this enormous psychological pressure, Spassky seems to collapse in the first part of the match, and he makes some blunders that some chess experts find difficult to believe in a world champion player. Of course, Fischer in game one had made a Patzer's error, a wood pusher's error, an error which to this day chess players can't believe that he made such an elementary mistake. But in the last phase of the match, Spassky fights back, he digs deep, and there were a series of draws, at the time an unprecedented series of seven draws in a row, in many of the games absolutely thrilling. And we should never forget that Spassky is himself one of the greatest attacking chess players of all time.
David, explain what happened at the end, because it wasn't like, you know, in baseball, a home run with the bases loaded at the bottom of the ninth inning.
No, it was the best of 24 games, which means that Fischer needed to win 12.5 points to win the World Championship. After a session, after 5 hours of play, the game was adjourned. Spassky went off to study the position, decided it was hopeless, and instead of returning to the board at the next session, phoned in his resignation. And so it was a major anticlimax. There was a big crowd assembled to see Fischer claim the crown, and of course Spassky didn't turn up. There was an empty seat opposite Fischer. When it came to the final ceremony, Fischer was handed his winning cheque at the podium. He opened the envelope to scrutinise the cheque to make sure he'd been paid the right amount. He sat down. During the course of that evening, he studiously ignored the speeches and at one stage got out his pocket chess set, pulled Spassky over, and they started studying that last game, the 21st game. He couldn't even relax even then.
Before the games and during the matches, Fischer's demands were legendary. The cameras that were making too much noise, the change of the chessboards, at one point the change of venue. Afterwards, there were allegations that Boris Spassky's food had been poisoned, that there were fumes that were coming from Bobby Fischer's chair. I mean, what was that all about?
Well, the Soviets, of course, are congenitally suspicious. They were genuinely concerned that their champion Boris Spassky was being got at. Perhaps he was being got at by hypnotists. Perhaps he was being got at by parapsychology. Perhaps his food was being tampered with. A sample of Boris's orange juice was carried by a KGB courier back to Moscow to be analysed. Two leading psychiatrists got a free ride to Iceland to study the situation. So all that indeed happened. But, as I say, you have to allow for the Soviet suspicion.
What was the political legacy of this match, since it had been billed as, you know, the Soviets against the free world?
Very few political, if no political implications at all, but some important chess implications. And the match gave a great impetus to the world of chess. One American chess player said it was like money falling from heaven. Suddenly people experts could turn professional. Prize monies went up. There was talk of founding a professional league. Everybody was suddenly interested in chess. Everybody was playing chess. There was a boom in chess books. There was a boom in chess sets. And the very sad fact for chess, not just in America, but in Britain and the West, and actually all around the world, was that when Bobby Fischer failed to defend his title, which he did in 1975, and became an almost complete recluse, his disappearance sucked out much of that boom in chess interest.
David Edmonds and John Idenow are the authors of Bobby Fischer Goes to War, How the Soviets Lost the Most Extraordinary Chess Match of All Time. They joined us from London. David, thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
And John, thank you very much.
It was a pleasure. Thank you.
That's the story of the 1972 championship, but much has happened in the past 32 years. To find out about the 1992 rematch between Fischer and Spassky, where the two men are now, and why Bobby Fischer can't come back to the United States, visit our website at npr.org. You'll also be able to listen to the full interview with David Edmonds and John Idenow.